Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Understanding and Managing Chemotherapy Side Effects. Now, this is a really critically important program that we're doing today, and it's really demonstrated by all of your interest in the program today. It's a major issue when you're undergoing chemotherapy treatments, and I think you're going to get a lot of tips today in terms of really how to really manage your side effects. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the program today over 1,209 people on the call today. That's a lot of people on this call, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities, and you come from small cities, and you come from suburban areas as well as rural and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from many countries. I'm going to list them: Africa, Argentina, Australia, Brazil, Canada, the Dominican Republic, Ireland, Pakistan, Singapore, United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and this is a credit to each of you. You are clearly a group of information seekers. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about today's program. There also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations as really resources, as free resources for you to access additional help from. And there also is an evaluation form. And I would ask you all to please complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs and the topics you want us to offer moving forward? Today's program is one that you have, obviously many of you, unanimously have requested us to do on an ongoing basis. And so we are listening to your questions and we are really and your recommendations to us, and we are then trying to offer programs that best meet your needs. Now, this activity today is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen. I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today. I want to start by introducing our first speaker is Dr. Lowell Anthony. Dr. Anthony is professor of medicine, section of hematology and oncology, Louisiana State University Health Sciences Center. And Dr. Anthony is going to really talk about a lot of the issues around chemotherapy side effects, understanding the causes of chemotherapy side effects, managing nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and constipation, and practical tips to deal with fatigue and infection control. I'm now going to turn this program over to Dr. Anthony.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's a real pleasure to be talking with everyone today concerning the managing side effects of chemotherapy. When we think of cancer chemotherapy, a whole host of treatments arise. Literally, we're talking about hundreds of drugs. The physician prescribing these will, or should at least, let you know what kind of side effects to experience, that you might experience. And this would be some of the early questions and should be included in the consent form that you might sign outlining the different kinds of toxicities, really based upon what kind of treatment you're going to receive. When we think about side effects of chemotherapy, we like to divide them into those that potentially could be life-threatening and then those that are more nuisance or cosmetic, in other words. From a life-threatening perspective, we think more of infection. We think more of bleeding. Our drugs can certainly suppress the bone marrow, and with such effects, we see a reduction in blood counts, white blood cell counts specifically for infection, red blood cell counts specifically for fatigue, and then platelets specifically for bleeding. So those are some of the initial concerns that your physician will be addressing and potentially either adjusting the dose that you may be receiving up front based upon individual characteristics or adjusting the dose should those side effects be present and to reduce the likelihood of them returning on subsequent cycles. Again, it's dependent upon the goals of chemotherapy. If the goal is to cure, then managing these side effects become even more important because there's not an intent to reduce the dose either on the front end or secondary. If the intent is to control the disease, then we don't want to make the treatment potentially worse than what the symptoms of the disease might be. So that's part of the upfront planning of receiving chemotherapy. Why do we experience these kinds of side effects? What happens is that cells in the body are continuously dividing at different rates, and some of the fastest rates would be in the GI tract and in the hair. And as the drugs are targeting cells that are dividing, then we might expect that you might experience some hair loss, and that would be particularly noticeable in drugs that are given for breast cancer specifically, the anthracyclines, which also are given for other kinds of tumors as well. But that's a classic side effect from the drug class anthracyclines is alopecia. And that's what worries patients a lot, is how they look. Physicians and nurses and caregivers are particularly concerned about how patients look, but we also are most concerned about getting people through these treatments safely and managing the cancer. And then the side effects, particularly alopecia, will take care of itself with time. So the cause is the fact that these cells that are responsible for the GI tract absorption, specifically of nutrients in the GI tract and other places in the body, are going to be sensitive to the chemotherapy in the same way that we think the cancer is going to be sensitive. Nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, are related to the toxic effects of these drugs on the GI mucosa. The nausea and vomiting can occur immediately. Sometimes it even occurs in an anticipatory manner if people are potentially conditioned. We try to avoid that kind of nausea and vomiting because we want to suppress and prevent nausea and vomiting on the front end. Chemotherapy drugs are classified according to what we refer to as their emetogenic potential and what class those drugs may be. And regarding that depends upon the exact regimen that the antiemetics are used, either as single agents or in combination with other drugs. So what you should be hearing today is that nausea and vomiting is preventable, and should it be breakthrough or delayed nausea and vomiting, then additional challenges may be present. But again, these can be handled potentially as well. So nausea and vomiting advances have occurred as a side effect of chemotherapy have been impressive over the last 20 to 25 years, and this no longer becomes the same kind of side effect that we've seen in the past. Constipation, on the other hand, is probably due. There are just a fewer chemotherapy drugs that might cause this. More often we see it with narcotics that are being given for pain control. Constipation would be dealt with in an individual basis with diet modification and potentially with cathartics. Should the constipation be severe, there are new medications that will work through blocking the opiate receptor in the GI tract that could be used, but these are more difficult to use because they're given IV and usually given in the inpatient setting. So diarrhea, on the other hand, is usually managed with diet changes immediately. If there's dehydration involved, we have to replace that fluid with IV fluids. The problem with vomiting with chemotherapy is if we don't prevent it on the front end, then we have to let it run its course on the back end. So should vomiting occur, then support in the context of IV fluids or some kind of oral support if possible, and then using potentially other classes of antiemetics or drugs that control emesis that might be more sedative. And this is they may not completely control it, but they make the experience maybe a little bit better, ease it a bit. I've also been asked to address fatigue. When we think about fatigue as a side effect of chemotherapy, this is a a side effect that may be drug dependent in as its ability to suppress the bone marrow. The first thing that we all can think about is reversible changes in the hemoglobin. Should the hemoglobin be maintained above 10, and that's our target, 10 to 11 is our target range. Up to 12 is considered normal, and at 12 we obviously would be thinking about other causes of fatigue if there is not anemia. However, once the hemoglobin falls below 10, then there's certainly a concern that hemoglobin could be responsible for some of the fatigue. Other medications have been looked at for fatigue. If we look at drugs that classically have been used, caffeine, for instance, even some of the other drugs that have been used for attention deficit disorder have been looked at, and they would be prescribed on an individual basis upon what the practicing physician or the managing physician would be seeing at that particular time. So fatigue also, we'd be thinking about that being reversible. The chemotherapy, when it's stopped, the fatigue should improve unless the fatigue is related to the underlying malignancy. Now, infection control brings us back to sort of where I started in terms of life-threatening complications of chemotherapy. When we administer drugs that we know are going to result in severe neutropenia, we would like to use what are called white blood cell growth factors. These cells in the bone marrow are turning over rapidly, and when we administer the chemotherapy a day after the administration of chemotherapy, then we would consider using these white blood cell growth factors. So that would potentially delay the time from the time that the chemotherapy is, you may say, affecting the normal white blood cell count to where we're starting to stimulate it. We don't want to be stimulating at the same time we're suppressing the white blood cell count. There have been studies done looking at giving these growth factors right immediately after chemotherapy, and right now it's not recommended to do that. So it's a major effort for all parties to delay that by approximately 24 hours, but that's the current guidelines, and that's what most people do at this particular time. So I'll turn this over back to you, Carolyn.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Anthony, for just an outstanding presentation, really, really very informative, really covering such a large array of topics, and I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much, as always. And our next speaker is Dr. Douglas Peterson. Dr. Peterson is Chair, Head and Neck Oral Oncology Program, NAE Comprehensive Cancer Center, the University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Peterson is going to discuss guidelines for dental care during chemotherapy and managing mouth sores and dry mouth. And these are very important issues for all of you on this call. I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Peterson.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. My pleasure as well to be part of today's discussion. It's very important, and I appreciate the opportunity. As we talk about guidelines for dental care during chemotherapy, it becomes important to realize that this conversation between the patient and the families with the oncology team, including the dental team, actually should begin well before the chemotherapy begins. By doing so, one can then work with the dental and rest of the team to try and prevent many of the mouth problems that might otherwise occur during chemotherapy. It's also important to realize that not all cancer treatments cause mouth problems either during or after the cancer therapy. The principal types of interventional therapies for cancer that do cause mouth problems or may cause mouth problems include head and neck radiation that's given to treat head and neck cancer, which is really a very different subject, so I won't be addressing that in detail today, but also chemotherapy. Some types of chemotherapy, particularly those chemotherapies that may be given in more than one cycle, may cause certain kinds of mouth problems. And those are some of the issues that I'll be addressing over the next few minutes. And then finally, it's also important to realize that some of the mouth complications in relation to chemotherapy only occur during the actual chemotherapeutic treatment, and then they go away, they resolve. However, given the complexity of some of the mouth problems, it is important to have a comprehensive evaluation by your healthcare providers in dental medicine, and in ways they can discuss with you. If they find an area in your mouth that needs treatment before the chemotherapy begins, that kind of dental checkup and selected dental treatment can really help set the stage for you to have a very successful chemotherapeutic experience. So it becomes important when you're discussing, as Dr. Anthony mentioned, as you're discussing with your oncologist and the oncology nursing team, and you're deciding on the chemotherapeutic approach, you can ask that team, are there any short-term or long-term effects on my mouth that are anticipated from the chemotherapy? The answer may be yes, and then you can discuss those in more detail, or the answer may be no, in which case it becomes more simple in relation to mouth care. But it's also important to ask, are there any problems that that may occur in my mouth that may complicate my chemotherapeutic management, including when my chemotherapy is finished? And so the issues, as Dr. Anthony mentioned, the white blood cell count and platelet count and so forth, those also become important considerations in some cases in relation to customizing your dental care before and after the chemotherapy treatment. These kinds of collaborations between you and your family, the dental and dental hygiene team, and the rest of the oncology team can in turn often lead to very, very positive outcomes of the chemotherapy. And there are many aspects, obviously, to consider. We don't have time to go into all of them today. Having said that, there are some excellent resources available to patients and their families and to the cancer team in order to guide in the decision-making and the treatments for the mouth care before, during, and after the chemotherapy. Cancer care is one superb example of such resources, and they in turn can refer you to other sources. I'd like to take just another 2 minutes now and talk a little bit about mouth cleaning and mouth care before and during the chemotherapy. As a dentist, I'll say it's important in all patients to have excellent health of your teeth and your gums and the lining tissues of your mouth. That's a very important goal for which we in the dental profession continually strive. And the role of the periodic dental examinations and cleanings is very important in that context. Now, having said that, it's also important to realize that not all the mouth disease that we may detect before you're starting your chemotherapy needs to be treated before your chemotherapy. So, for example, if your oncologist refers the patient to my team, for example, and we find a very minor dental cavity or an area that could look a little better with a cosmetic dental procedure, those may be very useful and important treatments, but we can often delay those until after your cancer treatment ends. On the other hand, if we find more advanced problems, types of infections such as deep cavities in the teeth or very serious severe gum disease, you may not be aware that you have this. Those are types of infections that could complicate your chemotherapeutic course, so it is important that we all work together to eliminate those risks before your chemotherapy begins. So again, if you can discuss these issues with your oncologist, your oncology nurse, the dental and dental hygiene team, we can go a long way to preventing or at least substantially reducing these risks. I'd like to now turn over in the next 4 minutes to the mouth sores and dry mouth, and then I'll introduce a few summary remarks. You may have heard about mouth sores, and in fact, they're becoming increasingly well publicized in the public literature. Certain types of chemotherapy can cause these sore mouths. The technical word that we use is mucositis. Now, these lesions, depending on the types of chemotherapy that the patient's receiving, can affect different parts of the lining tissues of the mouth. The lesions tend to go away in the 2 to 4 weeks after the chemotherapy ends, so they're not the type of complication that lasts for months and months and years and years. It's not a long-term concern. And there are a number of approaches that we can offer to help the patient prior to and during the mouth sore experience. For example, something as simple as using non-medicated mouth rinses, such as water or water and salt solutions, just to keep the tissues moist and clean, rinsing for a minute and swishing and then spitting out every 3 to 5 hours through the day, can go a long way just to keeping the mouth clean and simply protected. If the mouth does become sore, there are some very fine pain medication considerations that can be used, some locally administered topical agents that we call them, applied right to the sore area, we can teach you how to do this. Or if the pain becomes a little more substantial, there are some very, very effective pain medications that we can give by either a pill that you swallow or by injection. And then also, very importantly, mouth sores can, in some patients, contribute to infection. And as Dr. Anthony mentioned, infection is one complication that we all work very hard to prevent. And when it occurs, we want to detect it early and work aggressively to stop it. So if we do detect infection in relation to your mouth sores, then we'll work with the rest of your team to turn that infection around. There is one drug, it's called Palifermin. It's approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration for the use in some patients who are about to undergo a bone marrow or stem cell transplant and receiving high-dose chemotherapy that may be causing those mouth sores. That's the only FDA-approved drug that's molecularly targeted to prevent mouth sores in chemotherapy patients. And again, it's only for stem cell patients. Other drugs are in development, and hopefully they will become available over time. Just a word on dry mouth. My story here is fairly easy. Dry mouth in patients who receive head and neck radiation can be a significant lifelong problem. However, the good news is that if the patient is just receiving chemotherapy, chemotherapy itself is not traditionally associated with causing any dry mouth. Now, some of the other medications that you may receive in relation to your chemotherapy, such as the drugs to reduce or prevent the nausea, those may cause some temporary dryness to the mouth. However, the good news again here is that very simple approaches such as sipping water or sugarless drinks through the day, avoiding drinks with caffeine, don't use tobacco and alcohol because these can dry out the mouth, and then avoiding spicy or salty foods which may irritate the mouth that's dry, those can all very easily go a long way to making the mouth more comfortable. So in summary, not all patients develop mouth complications in relation to their chemotherapy. It is very important that the patient and the family work with the dentist, the dental hygienist, and the rest of the cancer team to address these issues upfront and throughout the cancer and chemotherapy experience. There are excellent resources, including those through Cancer Care, that provide a lot of very useful additional information. And again, this collective collaboration can lead to some very exciting, very positive outcomes during the chemotherapeutic and for years after the chemotherapy ends. I'll stop at this point, Carolyn. Thank you again very much for the opportunity to contribute.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Peterson. Again, an outstanding and very informative presentation, and I know there'll be questions for you. This is such an important area. You know, mouths are so important to us, and we actually need to keep them as well as we can and have some really good tips from Dr. Peterson, so thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Silver. Dr. Silver is Assistant Professor, Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Silver is going to really talk about describing neuropathy to your healthcare team and tips to cope. I now turn the program over to Dr. Silver.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you all for listening in on this program. This is important information. I want to talk a little bit about peripheral neuropathy and what that means. Peripheral neuropathy really is a problem with the nerves that are outside the central nervous system, which means outside the brain and the spinal cord. So if you can imagine in the periphery of your body, your fingers and your toes primarily is where you'll feel it. And we call this a stocking glove distribution, meaning that it occurs as if you were wearing stockings on your feet or gloves on your hands. Peripheral neuropathy certainly can occur with chemotherapy. Many chemotherapeutic drugs actually cause peripheral neuropathy, or they may exacerbate existing peripheral neuropathy. Peripheral neuropathy also can be caused by things like using alcohol, especially if you consistently drink alcohol, and particularly if you drink it quite a lot. In people with diabetes, they can also get peripheral neuropathy. So there are a number of other conditions that can cause peripheral neuropathy that may be worsened with chemotherapy. Chemotherapy can also cause it just on its own without any underlying condition. What a lot of people do when they go and they visit their medical oncologist is they start to complain of symptoms like tingling in their hands, maybe in their feet, loss of sensation. They might feel like sort of a numb feeling, like their hands don't work quite as well. And we actually go into schools and we talk to kids about disabilities. And one of the things that we do with kids is we tape up their fingers and we ask them now to try to button a shirt. And that sort of simulates what a peripheral neuropathy would do if you tried to tie your shoe or tried to button your shirt with your fingers taped together. They don't work really well. You can't feel really well and so on. And we only tape a couple of fingers together, but they really get the idea. So the symptoms really are pain, numbness, tingling, loss of sensation. And also weakness can be a symptom. And weakness is something that we do really care a lot about. We don't want people to get weaker. But loss of sensation itself can make you feel as though you're weak because your fingers and your feet just aren't working as well. They can cause balance problems if you have them in your feet because you need your feet and what we call proprioception, which means your feet knowing where they are in space and your brain knowing where your feet are in space, putting one foot in front of the other, being able to walk, for example, with your eyes closed. So proprioception can be affected. What to do if you have peripheral neuropathy? If you're complaining of symptoms and you're in the middle of chemotherapy, you certainly need to report your symptoms to your doctor. And you need to tell your doctor what problems you're having with this. Is it simply loss of sensation? Are you having trouble buttoning things? Are you having a lot of pain? Is there a lot of numbness and tingling? Is it keeping you up at night? Are you falling? Or are you tripping? All of those kinds of things are symptoms that you might want to report to your doctor. As chemotherapy goes on, it may actually get worse. And your doctor may decide, in fact, to lower the dose of the medications or even to delay treatment or even stop treatment. It just depends. If you're being tested for peripheral neuropathy, there are a number of things that can be done, including something as simple as just taking the end of a paper clip and seeing which fingers or toes feel like they're numb. Or we do something called two-point discrimination, which we have two different points that are sort of like two paperclip ends where you see how well someone can determine whether it's 1 point or 2 points without looking, and you can kind of get a sense of when they can discriminate between 1 and 2 points. There's these microfilaments you can use to test sensation. And we also test vibration and so on. And there's actually a test called electrodiagnostic studies. Some people call it EMG. But the electrodiagnostic study part that really helps with peripheral neuropathy is actually called a nerve conduction study. It's not the EMG part. It's the nerve conduction study part. And that's a special test that can be done by doctors, usually in neurology and physiatry, who do those studies. It's not always necessary, though. But those are specific tests that can really help your doctor figure out how bad is your peripheral neuropathy. The good news about peripheral neuropathy is that it can improve, and even quite dramatically over time. We always are most hopeful after chemotherapy is done when the neuropathy improves in the first few weeks to months. But it can improve up to 1 to 2 years later even. So there's a very long way between the nerves that go all the way to your feet and the ends of your toes and all the way to the ends of your fingers, and those nerves heal very slowly, and so it takes a long time sometimes. So there's a lot of hope, even 6 months out, 8 months out, a year out, and so on, to think that this might improve somewhat. If you have peripheral neuropathy, what should you do? Report symptoms to your doctor, avoid self-medicating, avoid or limit your drinking alcohol because this is toxic to your nerves. So if you're drinking alcohol and also taking chemotherapy, it's like having two things that are really toxic to your nerves at the same time. And control your blood sugars if you have diabetes. In terms of treatment options, medications may really help. And my patients often are confused about medications. They'll come in and they'll tell me that they've already tried medications or they're already on opiate-based medications or so on, and they don't really understand that there are specific medications that may help with nerve problems. So there's different classes of medications that we use to treat pain. Perhaps the best class are the anti-seizure medications for peripheral neuropathies. And these medications include gabapentin, which is also often known as Neurontin, and pregabalin, which is also often known as Lyrica. And these medications tend to be very helpful. There's other medications that may help as well. And I want to be careful about over-promising on the medications. They don't always help, but when they do, they can really be quite dramatic. The right dose is important, though, and your doctor will have to work with you if you decide to try some medications to treat the peripheral neuropathy on what the right dose is. Non-drug treatments, there's a lot of non-pharmacologic treatments, including relaxation therapy, meditation, acupuncture. Sometimes we use something called a TENS unit, which is transcutaneous nerve stimulation. And if you can imagine, kind of like a little cell phone attached to the side of your pants, and then these wires with sticky parts that go on your body. And there's these little signals that the TENS unit works on. And we used to think, and it's sort of a good way to think about how this might work. This is the way we used to think it works, but it's not exactly the way it works, but I still like this description because it helps people understand it, is that there's a gate in your brain, and the nerve signals go through the gate. And the TENS unit creates these other signals that don't allow the pain signals to get through the gate because they're sort of rushing the gate and going through first and blocking out the other signals. So TENS unit can really help sometimes. Physical and occupational therapy can also be very helpful, especially looking at strength and balance and coordination. You also want to pay attention to your feet if that's where your neuropathy is. Use a handheld mirror to check your feet for sores or open wounds. Make sure that your shoes are really comfortable. Extra depth and extra width are the key things that you want to tell someone. And there's orthopedic-style shoes that are – some are actually pretty attractive these days. But the terms you want to use are extra depth and extra width. Those give your feet a lot more room. You may want to have shoe inserts that help with positioning your feet better, an arch support, and so on. I sometimes get my patients to use what are called rocker bottom soles, and that's R-O-C-K-E-R, rocker bottom soles. And those just are soles that sort of roll over a little bit, and they help you walk better if you're really having a lot of problems with your feet. A cobbler can put a rocker bottom sole on almost any shoe except a high heel. And there's a number of sneakers that are coming out with rocker bottom soles, too. Sometimes the rocker is just too much, and you'll feel really unbalanced on that. So be careful of that. You want to start out with a very gentle rocker. If your hands are affected, you can use what we call Good Grips. Good Grips is actually a brand, but it is sort of this idea. There's a lot of different brands now where the handle is bigger than a normal handle, and so you don't have to hold it as tightly. So anything with a bigger handle, whether it's you're using, for example, a pen that's a little bit thicker than usual, or scissors or knives or hammers and things that are a little bit bigger in the handle, it just means that you don't have to grip it as tightly and they're easier to use. Cancer treatments can certainly wreak havoc with your body. You want to promote healing as much as possible, and there's a number of things that you can do to treat peripheral neuropathy. There's also a lot of hope for peripheral neuropathy in terms of improving on its own over time up to a certain point, and there's always, always, always new treatments coming out. We just had a new study released at Harvard Medical School recently on a new medication that's being tried for pain that's not yet out, so I don't want to get into the details of that, but really exciting things that are coming out, and so I do hope that everyone remains hopeful and advocates for themselves to get the best treatment they can.
I want to thank you very much, Dr. Silver, for just a really outstanding and very informative presentation. A lot of remarkable tips, things that people really don't know. They're just not, we just wouldn't know this if we didn't hear you speak. So thank you so much for this. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Before we take questions, I do want to comment on just some recommendations to handle hair loss. Now, our hair is an important part of our bodies. It's an important part of often our sense of self and our sense of self-esteem. And to some extent, there are some cancer treatments, as Dr. Anthony had mentioned, some chemotherapy agents that may affect our hair and may cause hair loss. So it's important up front when you hear your physician say that your oncologist tell you that is a side effect of the particular chemotherapy that is being recommended, that you have a discussion with your healthcare team about that and get a sense from them about how you should plan for that in terms of what they think the timing will be. Most people, we recommend that as soon as they hear that from their physician, that they begin to think about how they would like to handle this. Now, some people really prefer wearing a wig during the time that they've had hair loss, and they actually will try to get a wig really before their hair falls out. Actually really go somewhere, go to a fitter, go to an organization that offers those services, and get a wig before their hair actually falls out. And sometimes people prefer to get a wig in a little different shade than they might have had before, perhaps a little bit lighter, a little bit more flattering to them. And some people prefer their wig to look pretty much exactly as their hair had looked before. And most fitters can really try to accommodate what you wish. So we very much recommend that. So then you're all set. And then if you're traveling and your hair hasn't fallen out yet, do take the wig with you just in case you know you need to have it with you. So that's an important thing to be aware of. So some people, again, prefer really to have a wig during that time and really to then look as much as everybody else as they can, because our sense of normalcy can be very important during our cancer treatments. Now, some people also prefer also to have really quite creative scarves and turbans, or to do a combination of wigs, scarves, and turbans. And there are a lot of turbans that are out there and scarves that can be worn that really do are very flattering and actually help people to feel normal and attractive and just like themselves in terms of, that they can just get on with their life, and that's really very important. We do suggest that if you're going to get a wig, that you might want to check with your health insurance to see if your wig is covered. It's hair prosthesis is the word that's used, and if there is coverage for that. If you don't have coverage for it, do call the staff at Cancer Care. We certainly can help you to figure out ways to get a wig if you wish to get one. Also, just so you all know, I think you may have heard of the Look Good, Feel Better program, which is sponsored by the American Cancer Society. It exists in communities throughout the country in the United States, and actually it's a wonderful resource, and many hospital centers have boutiques as well where they will fit you with a wig so that if you wish to have a wig that you'll be able to have one. Some people actually get more than one wig, a backup wig, just so they have an extra one so that they feel more in control. I think the goal here is to have you determine what would work best for you, and then to have multiple choices that you can choose. Some people wear hats, may wear scarves, turbans, or wigs. So there are a lot of different choices. And increasingly, we are seeing some people who actually choose to not camouflage the fact that they've lost their hair, to really go bald and to just absolutely, that's who they are and that's who they wish to be during that experience. So it is an individual decision in terms of what you each decide to do, and I would definitely suggest that you go ahead and talk with your healthcare team. Some people find it helpful to join a support group, to speak with a social worker about what would be best for you, and also to think about your environment, the people around you, and what would work best both for you and the people you care about, and if you're in the workplace, what would work best in terms of the whole environment you're in so that you can get on with really the momentum and the importance of your life. So I want to thank you for listening, and now we do have time for questions. We actually have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Mary to explain to you how to queue up for questions, so I'm going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Mary?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Mary W.
Hi, I have a question about osteonecrosis of the jaw when you're taking bisphosphonates. Oral IV, not oral bisphosphonates, IV bisphosphonates.
And your question?
Just from happening.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's a good question. Dr. Peterson, can you address that question in a general way?
Yes. I'd be happy to. Osteonecrosis of the jaw is a relatively recently identified event that's associated with this specific type of drug. The first reports began to emerge in the literature around 2003. So it's a relatively new toxicity relative to our clinical experience, but what we know includes the following. First of all, as you point out, it's primarily, at least so far, associated with intravenously administered bisphosphonates, and particularly those drugs that have been administered for at least 12 to 18 months. Secondly, the drug itself, bisphosphonate, isn't a conventional chemotherapy. Bisphosphonates can be used in some cancer patients to help the cancer treatment, including response of cancer cells to the cancer treatment, but it is not in and of itself. Bisphosphonates in and of itself is not a chemotherapeutic agent in the classic sense. And thirdly, it's important to realize that the incidence, the occurrence of these lesions in the mouth is extremely unlikely. We're still getting good understandings of how common these problems are, but really, in the scheme of things, they're a relatively rare event. When they do occur, it's classically in association with either some trauma to the tissue, such as a denture that's rubbing, perhaps a dental extraction that needed to be done, or some other stimulus, some other cause like that may be associated with actually triggering this to occur, but again, in a relatively small number of patients. And finally, if it does occur, it's important to report any changes in your mouth, such as pain or swelling, to your dentist or your oncologist. And then usually very conservative approaches, just keeping the area clean, antibiotics, and constant following, and just gentle nurturing it back to health, may take a few months, is probably the best way to go. That seems to be what the literature is saying at present.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Allison S.
Is it safe to go out into the sun while you're having chemotherapy?
That's an excellent question. Thank you. Dr. Anthony, would you address that question?
Yes, Allison. We do encounter this quite often, particularly with drugs that we use to treat breast and colorectal cancer. The fluoropyrimidines are one class that certainly do make the skin more sensitive to sun exposure. So what we ask people to do is to limit the amount of time between 10 a.m. and maybe 2 or 3 p.m. when the sun rays are the most intense, and to use sunscreens often. So in other situations, it might be best to avoid sun exposure altogether. So it really depends on individual characteristics, but warning people that this is a problem can certainly allow people to prepare either with sunscreens, avoid the intensity, or to cover up really, really well. I do have a number of patients that come in. I practice here in New Orleans. They come in with sweaters and everything on, and I'm sitting there asking them, you know, is it that cold inside? Oh, no, they're just trying to avoid sun exposure. So you might inquire specifically with your caregiver related to the drugs that could be causing it, because it is multiple agents will do it.
And we would also suggest that if you've had hair loss during that time, you might want to really just get a big floppy hat that if you're going to be outside as well. That would be a really good thing, an additional protection as well for your head and scalp. That would be important too. Okay, our next question.
Our next question comes from Jacqueline W.
Yes, hello. I'd like to ask about management of bone and tendon pain, for example, when one is on an aromatase inhibitor.
Okay, I'm going to ask, I guess, Dr. Anthony and Dr. Silver perhaps to address that.
Yes, Jacqueline, pain that may be associated with aromatase inhibitors may be more of a general pain where we would use analgesics that may start off with being simple with acetaminophen or working up accordingly from acetaminophen to potentially ibuprofen. and then on to narcotics or combination with ibuprofen and acetaminophen. So these pains are individualized, certainly worse in some people than others, but should be taken as an important side effect of these medications that should be controlled with agents within these classes that I've mentioned.
On the rehab side of that, controlling pain is really important, and so you want to manage the pain. Some pain you really can't work through very easily. It makes things worse. But the pain that you get with the aromatase inhibitors is actually something that you can work through pretty easily in terms of staying very functional, and you won't hurt yourself. So, for example, on the rehab side, we'd want to really focus on not only controlling the pain, but also keeping someone as physically fit as possible, improving their strength so that they don't have as much stress on their joints, and keeping them as active as possible. So the pain shouldn't limit you in terms of your function, although you do want to control it.
Do you want to say a bit about that, about the strength issue, or what you mean by that?
It was interesting what you asked about tendon pain. I think bone pain and tendon pain for the aromatase inhibitors, and there's a lot of different pains people complain of, and you definitely want to make sure that you know which pain is which. If you have, for example, tendon pain in your ankle, let's say your Achilles tendon, that's probably not an aromatase inhibitor kind of pain. And which tends to be more diffuse. It can be more joint pain or aches, or sometimes muscle aches or pain. So we call those arthralgias or myalgias. So I always want to know, like, what pain are you really talking about? And often people will come in and they'll tell me, well, I have aromatase pain, but it's really not from that. It's from something else. So making sure that you know what you're treating, and I always say let's start with the right diagnosis because that makes treating things a lot better. Improving strength really helps a lot, but for example, let's take the case of the Achilles tendonitis. If you come in and you say, well, gee, I have pain in my Achilles, and I think it's from aromatase inhibitors, which may or may not be a factor, but again, that wouldn't be typical, then strengthening would not be appropriate for that right away. You'd really want to calm the tendonitis down and so on. If you have true aromatase pain, you can work through that and you can strengthen. So you're not going to make it worse if you do strengthening. And again, a supervised exercise program for anyone with pain is probably a good idea. But there are some pains you can really work through and some you can't. Starting with the right diagnosis is the best thing.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Gail Kay.
Yes, I was interested in two things. One, with Dr. Silver, I really didn't get that unit you were talking about that you put on. It sounds like it's sends electrical impulses. So I was interested in hearing more about that and what it's called.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Sure. So sometimes in physical therapy, people will get something called e-stim, electrical stimulation. So many people have kind of had some familiarity with electrical currents. Well, a TENS unit, and it's called TENS, 10 like the number with an S at the end, TENS unit. And you can Google that. You'll see a lot of information come up on TENS units. But a TENS unit is something that you can wear, and it can help with your pain. The way I recommend that people do it is they have what's called a TENS trial in physical therapy or occupational therapy. So your doctor writes an order for PT for a TENS trial. They try it on you in physical therapy. And if you like it and it seems to help, then what happens is the physical therapist will fill out some paperwork and your doctor will sign it to get you a TENS unit, which is how your insurance pays for it. So you can also get them just online, but I like people to go through that process where they have a TENS trial, because sometimes people really hate it. Sometimes they turn it on and people say, oh, I just hate the way that feels. That's awful. But a lot of times they really like it. So they do a TENS trial, and then the physical therapist fills out some paperwork, and the doctor signs it, and your insurance usually covers it.
Excellent. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Susan S.
Yes, this is about dental care. I was wondering, because I was reusing regular mouthwash and flossing, and my nurse said that I shouldn't do that, and they suggested biotin or something like that, and I'm wondering what you think of that.
Okay, thank you. That's an excellent question. Dr. Peterson, would you address that in a general way? Or?
Sure, thank you, and thank you for that question, Susan. As we talked about in my section, we emphasized the importance of good basic mouth care. And I think that's where the combination of working with your dentist and dental hygienist to make sure that the mouth care you're using, the dental brushing and the dental flossing, and making sure that there's no injury to the lining tissues of your mouth going into the chemotherapy, during the chemotherapy, and for the years after the chemotherapy is always a very important thing. As far as individual products, it really becomes decisions based on that discussion with your dental team, and there are a number of products out there. I always start with the simple approaches of just saline and salt waters, things like that, and then you and the dentist can talk about some of these other options as well, see what fits best for you and is most effective for you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Lisa T.
Hi. My question is about diet and when you're dealing with nausea, and basically all I've been able to keep down is crackers. You start to build up an appetite. You're on probably day 4 or 5 of when you've had the chemo. And I'm just not sure what would be, something good that would be sustained, give you energy. I'm just really hesitant to eat anything because I just don't want to get sick again. Any suggestions?
Lisa, thank you for that excellent question. Why don't you and I talk afterwards? So I'm going to ask Dr. Anthony to address your question in a general way so that he can provide some general guidelines for everyone on the call, and then I really, really like to talk with you afterwards so we can really, it sounds like this is really very hard, and I'm sure there are many people on the call who are struggling as well. Dr. Anthony?
Well, I think the good news with diet-related changes with chemotherapy is going to get better as you get further away from the treatment. So these kinds of events usually are what we look at as acute within 24 hours of administration, and then as they get more chronic, then it requires more involvement with the healthcare team. And so if it goes beyond 3 days, then change in taste can be potentially bothersome, continuous nausea, as you've mentioned, Lisa. And here there's no easy answer. We have to control the nausea, and if that's being controlled, then we have to look at what your caloric intake might be and then boost that. And I didn't really mean to have a play on word there, but there are nutritional supplements that we use that maybe Ensure or Boost or things like this, Sustacal, that may be the bridge between not eating a normal diet but then attempting to get adequate calories in. There are ways that we can boost the appetite if that's the primary issue. So that can be also addressed if it's appetite, just lack of an appetite or such. But really, change in diet we'd like to do to control diarrhea, for instance, and then as it relates to maybe nausea, that part has to be individualized because we don't want to be forcing feedings that may be increasing the symptom. So the number one thing is why is it delayed? For instance, we expect a certain amount. If it's protracted, then it needs to really be looked into, investigated to make sure something else is not going on.
Excellent. And so, at least we want you to work very closely, and everyone, with your healthcare team. Some people actually do see one of the dietitians on the team as well. But of course, I think what Dr. Anthony has said, figuring out really what's going on, is so critically important. I want to thank all of our speakers today. They have just been outstanding. We just want to all give them a great round of applause. They can't hear us, but we all think they were terrific. And I just want to thank them all. I want to thank all of you who queued up and asked such terrific questions, because your questions really enhance the call. We know you ask the questions to get information for yourself, but by asking the question, you end up helping everybody on the call. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening as well. I do want to remind you that this is a one-hour education program, and that we plan a program like this, we realize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So with that in mind, I do want you to note that although this program will soon close, the services that you can access from Cancer Care for free, those are endless and continue really as long as you need them. So I just want to briefly identify what those services are so that you can all access them. And also, if you didn't get to ask your question, you can go ahead and call our staff here as well at Cancer Care. Now, Cancer Care has a staff of 60 master's-level trained oncology social workers, and we are here to provide lots of different sources of help. We provide practical and financial assistance. We also have a copay foundation as well. So we definitely can help you with those really practical money matters, things that you really are quite troubling during the cancer experience that can be very difficult. We also offer people that you can talk with. Fancy word for that is counseling, but someone that you can talk with who really will listen to you and really help you to try to find your way with the concerns and questions that you might have. So definitely do use our staff just to talk to them. We also offer support groups. We do those support groups over the telephone and online, whichever you prefer, which is more convenient for you. It's really nice to talk with other people sometimes in a group who are sharing some similar concerns that you have and to really kind of problem solve together. It can be very, very helpful and really help to feel less alone when you're doing that as well. We also have lots of materials and booklets and materials and pamphlets and fact sheets, and of course we have these Connect workshops. We have a very, very robust website with lots of information. We have all these programs are available as well as podcasts, so you can listen to them again and again if you wish to, or listen to programs you might have missed. So there's lots of help that we offer at Cancer Care. And then I did mention that we did partner with all these other organizations as well, so there's a lot of help out there. And perhaps most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer, with your side effects, with your concerns, with getting on with your life. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support, and we are here to help you. And I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.